Hello, and welcome to The Commissioner. My name is Randy Sawson. This is Episode 6, Commissioning 101. So what is a music video commissioner? If I had to break it down, it's kind of a Venn diagram of where a creative movie producer who would hire the director and the production team, a movie studio, because as a commissioner, you basically are financing your own movie or video, as it were, a brand manager, where your brand is the artist and you need to make sure you're making the right product for that artist, and kind of a zeitgeist predictor, if you will, where you're knowing what is out there in the culture of music, depending on the genre, and what other artists are doing, and how you can be unique and thoughtful for the artist, but also make something that's very creative that captures the attention of the population. To back in the day when I was making videos, there was a very closed distribution system, so they were pivotal to selling music, which is much different than it is today, where you can stream anything you want and videos are judged on views, but I think most of the time people are just listening to them. Not that they don't watch them, you know, because I do think people do watch videos. I just don't think they watch them 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times. I think they watch it a couple times and then you listen to the video as the audio. So that's kind of where that Venn diagram kind of, you're in the middle of that kind of four intersectional, really important pieces. And that is a music video commissioner. It's kind of it can be somewhat enigmatic, because I don't know that it's something you can fill out on a school wish list with a counselor. I don't know that you go to school for that, you know, kind of like being a manager for an artist. I don't think you go to school for that either, but it's an incredible job and something that I loved doing for many years. Okay, so that's what a music video commissioner kind of is from 30,000 feet. But what does a music video commissioner do? You basically are in charge of making the music video for the artist at the label. So where do you start, right? So the where you start is the marketing, A&R, promotion department pick a song, right? They've decided whatever the artist is, they've made a record and they're picking a song. And depending on what it is, it can be the first single from a new release. It can be the second single from a big hit record. It can be the second single from a record from a big artist that had a stiff first single. There are a myriad of things that are, you know, determined on that, you know, song that gets picked. But the video commissioner doesn't pick the song. You're given a song. And then you listen to that song, right? And you start to think, you know, about what the artist has done in the past, or maybe this is their first video, where they fit into the marketplace, what would be good for them, what their visual things are. You meet with the artist and the manager usually and talk to them about what their thoughts are. And you're given a budget, which can range, you know, back in the day, the lower end videos were $75,000 to $100,000, and you know, at the high end it was $1,000,000+ for, you know, it wasn't uncommon for bigger artists to spend $1,000,000 on a video. I'm not sure what budgets are today, but you know, I'm guessing people do spend a lot of money on them. If you want to get good people and quality people to do really good film work, you need to pay them, as they should get paid. So once you have a kind of an idea of what the artist wants to do, and you should come to that meeting, I usually did anyways, would come to the meeting with a kind of an idea of what you're thinking and where they would fit in at that point to the zeitgeist, if you will, of the music thing, depending on the genre, be it hip hop or rock or pop. You know, each artist has their own fan base, and you obviously want to please that fan base, but you're always looking to expand the fan base without being alienating to the fan base. you come to the the meeting with ideas, and then you leave there with a basic understanding of kind of what it is you are setting out to do with this music video. From there, you call production companies who represent directors and talk to the either executive producer or the rep for the director, and kind of discuss the directors that you're interested in and their availability and the interest. You know, bigger artists pull in. Obviously, there's a lot of younger music video directors that want to do bigger artists because it's a great opportunity for them in their career, which sometimes, you know, would happen. There's also, back in the day, there was a lot of, competition for the bigger directors, and they were very particular and, you know, would pass on a lot of the times I would call to see if a Floria Sigismondi was interested, or a Sophie Mueller, or a David Fincher, or a Spike Jonze. You know, those kind of directors would be very picky. They tend to have relationships with artists that they like to work with, especially as they got bigger and started to do more commercials and feature films. They, you know, pretty much would turn down a lot of video work due A, to availability, B, to lack of interest in working with the artists. And it wasn't necessarily mean-spirited. It was just, you know, creatively, they didn't think they could bring something to the party. And so from there, once you have a list of directors that you know are available, because you're obviously looking at scheduling this shoot, right? And there's a promotion and marketing team is like, here's your song, here's when we're releasing it, here's when you have to have the video done. The whole process usually takes about 6 to 10 weeks, you know. The longer the better, obviously, from a film production standpoint, because, you know, putting everything together and budgeting and availability, depending on what the process is or the idea is and locations and et cetera. And then also based on when the artist is available. You know, bigger artists have tours that they're on, especially if it's a second single, they're already touring. So sometimes you have to go to location, which you have to fit into your budget, and all these, you know, kind of variables that exist for the project to go forward. So you talk to the production companies, get a list of directors, go back to the managers and let them know that, you know, here's the list, here's what we're going to get treatments in, give the production company a date, you know, by this date. A treatment is usually 1 page to 3 pages. Some people use, visuals. Just a quick breakdown, synopsis, summary of what they want to do. It's, you know, pie in the sky. I would always have this really fun challenge of, challenging directors to, give me a video treatment in one sentence. And I think the Spike Jonze had those. I don't know that he did them in one sentence, but if you've ever seen the Dinosaur Jr. video that he did, you know, it's like Manhattan as a par five, or that Wax video that he did with, you know, man on fire running to catch a bus. You know, like, it was those kind of things are just, you know, or that Beastie Boys Sabotage video, you know, a Quentin Martin cop show from the 70s intro, you know. So those were always like, oh, I get it. I totally know what that could be. And then obviously the brilliance of the director would come through, hopefully, in that thing. But most directors can't do that. And I get it. It's not easy. That is not an easy challenge. And a lot of times as a director, you want to explain yourself. So they write summaries. It's, 1, 2, 3 paragraphs, 5 paragraphs. The longer it is, the harder it is to digest. So most production companies go through that process. And, we'll edit it to the point where it's they know they're sending you something that's they feel good about, that they can do for the budget, and, that they can, that's readable, so that me as the commissioner and the artist and the manager look at it and it hopefully jumps off the page and they're excited about it. That becomes, so eventually you get down to that, oh, this is a great idea. You can do a conference. Sometimes artists want to talk to the directors. Sometimes they know the director, and that becomes an easier thing. Most of the time they don't. So they would want to do a quick call, just to kind of have them explain it. They have some questions. You know, artists are very particular about their brand and what they want to do. Directors are very particular about their idea and what they want to do. So the commissioner's job is to delicately make sure that both are served properly so that you can have the artists with their integrity of their brand intact and the director to give you the best possible video. And that is a little delicate thing that you learn as you do the job. I came from before I was a commissioner, I was actually at a production company representing directors. So I, you know, obviously had that side of me, but would work with a lot of artists and was able to, you know, understand and get my directors to, I wouldn't say bend, but, you know, appreciate the artist's point of view because it's very important. And ultimately it's their vision. It's the director who brings it to life and puts that, but the artist has to be in front of the camera. So it becomes quote unquote their video. So from once you have a treatment and then they give you a budget, as far as budgets go, I was always very open about my budgets. I know a lot of people don't do that. And I wouldn't say there's a right or wrong way to do it. It becomes you as a person. If I was given $150,000 to make a video, I would usually go to the production company with probably $125,000 or $130,000, depending on the artist, knowing that I had costs built in. Some artists have their own stylists. When you deal with a lot of hip hop artists, there's a lot of entourage that has to be covered in the cost of the budget. And so if you're flying in a number of people, you know, a solo artist or a band, you're talking about, you know, 4 to 6 people, maybe with the manager, 7 or 8 with a tour manager. You know, hip hop artists can be 10, 12, 15 people. And those people have to be flown in and put up at a hotel, and there has to be ground transportation. There's usually meals that have to be accounted for. So, you know, you want to make sure that you're giving yourself enough money in your budget that you handle that as the commissioner, because it is your responsibility to make sure you bring the video in on budget. And so, I'd like to give the production company as much of the budget as possible, because I always felt that A, music video people work their asses off and need to get paid, and B, the more money you spend, if you spend it properly and really put it on the camera, you get what you pay for. You really do. You can really push things in. And, you know, it is your job as a commissioner to know what things cost. So when you look at a budget, when they finally do turn in a budget, you can go through, it's usually a line item budget that's done very close to an AICP, which is the commercial production budget. So it's, you know, broken down by lines and broken down by departments and broken down by costs of day rates and days and equipment and, you know, in video, you have to, you know, do posts. When I first started doing video, most of it was shot on film. So part of the budget was, you know, after the, you know, you shot everything on film, you had to transfer it or do what's known as a telecine to get it to a digital realm to be able to edit on, you know, Avids or, you know, at one point Final Cut was there. This is kind of when I was doing it, was before Adobe, but either way, it's a non-linear digital realm that all the film had to be transferred. And in that transfer, you could give it a look, because you had colorists that would take the film and process, you know, give it a real interesting look. In the beginning when I did that, it wasn't that. We used to edit on, you know, Sonys and 3/4-inch tapes, and you would have to physically put in the tapes, and it would have to read the code. And so, but once Avid came in, it became a much more fluid process. But either way, you still had to do it on film and then transfer it to digital. Now, pretty much everyone shoots on digital, and you can even set cameras, looks in cameras, although I'm not sure why you would do that. But you could. You can do that if you wanted to. So it's a little bit easier process. But there's still a telecine. I'm sure you still want to set your look and still get that, you know, colorize the raw footage to make it look like your vision, whatever that director and the DP are. All right, so now you've got the treatment, you got the budget, it works, the artist and management is signed off, you have your shoot day, You start to work with the production company on who they're hiring, who the director wants to hire for the director of photography and for the production designer, and you know where the location is to make sure that it's doable, and any sort of special requests that you might have for the artists where they need to have, you know, if you're going to be on a remote location or something, making sure that there's a star wagon so that they can get ready and that there's air conditioning, because if it's hot out there, they're going to need to not look sweaty and disgusting in front of the camera. So you get all that sorted. I was always a commissioner who, I don't know, I knew people that I liked and that would work, and I wanted to at least sign off on the director of photography and production designer. But I would never stop somebody. I never had a list of people I didn't work with. I was never spiteful like that. I just sometimes know that people take longer, and sometimes that didn't work for some artists. I've had a couple of jobs, which when I'll get into in specific videos, where we did have to, you know, get rid of certain people on the crew for personality reasons and whatnot. So, you know, that becomes an issue. But for the most part, I pretty much let directors hire who they wanted to hire. Or at least I think I did. I'm guessing once these come out, they'll let me know that I was the ogre, but I don't feel like I was. So that's at least my experience of it. There's not a massive pre-pro in music video because of time and money. Usually I'll just go through with the executive producer and the director on a quick call, kind of talking about the day, you know, and then get to the shoot. And when I would get to the shoot, I would, you know, immediately go into the production office, talk to the line producer who is responsible for the whole shoot as far as production goes, and then, you know, get a call sheet and a shooting schedule and try and sit with the first AD to figure out the day and see how realistic it is and see what the plans are. Like anything else, everyone has their style. My style for music video has always been, you know, while you're setting up to do something great, try and shoot a performance of the artist. Because at the end of the day, that pretty much can always just be the, it's a fail safe, right? You get a good performance in with the artist performing the song to the camera, and you pretty much have the basis of a music video. Not every music video is like that, and you can't do that for every music video, and some guys and some girls don't want to do that, and I respect that. Some videos have no performance at all, so you know that's not something you can do for that particular video. But for the bulk of the videos, it's usually a good way to get started, and it gets the artist feeling better about themselves when they're performing the song. That's, you know, that's the bulk of what you're doing on the shoot. And then, you know, you have your, your shoot when you're doing, most of the time it was a 2-day shoot. Sometimes, you know, like I said, the lower budgets when you're at 75, I know it sounds like ridiculous, but when you really have a good crew with a high-end DP who's got a real grip and a gaff, a whole electric team that has, you know, theirs and utilities, and then a production designer and a costume designer, and you have catering and you have location fees and you have production, you know, people get paid rates as they should. I was always a firm believer that you work a day, you get paid. So, you know, believe it or not, filmmaking is expensive, and rightly so, because you're paying for someone's services and they're not, there's no ongoing residual for a music video. The only people that get paid on a residual are the artist and the label. So when you're a director and you put together a crew and everyone shows up for that day of work or days of work, they get paid their day rate and then they're done. And then that's it. They don't, and it could, you know, it could, in today's world, they can have a billion views on YouTube. I don't know of any organization that's collecting fees for the crew. So I always, you know, I would always have the discussion with people. It's so expensive. It's, and I'm like, meh, it's not really. You're actually getting a really great deal for your dollar. Because you have these high-end, amazingly talented crew people who are doing really, really great work putting together this, you know, magic, you know. And unlike feature films, most of the time there's no dialogue. You know, the playback is what's known as MOS, which is without sound. So you're not recording sound. You're doing it to a track. So there's been an audio package made. And if it's a rock band or something, you know, they're playing back to the song that's played. There's time code. And so, you know, that's, you know, having produced a couple movies myself, like once you roll sound, there has to be, you know, complete quiet and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of times you're not experiencing that on a music video set, which does make it for an easier environment. And you can shoot in places where you probably couldn't shoot a movie because there's noise, but you don't have to really record it. Now, I'm not saying that you don't have audio, because there are times when you do have audio and there is dialogue and you do shoot a scene with, you know, the artist talking, or there's an acting scene with somebody. And so, you know, that in those situations, you do need to record sound. But for the bulk of them, there's not a lot of audio recorded. So you get your shoot in. Usually, I don't have a lot of money that I've left over, so you try not to go into overtime. Videos tend to have overtime. That's just the way it is. I think production companies, you know, a lot of them may be out of business because of that. They do invest in the director. Sometimes they want to do things that make it go over. If it was my artist's fault for going overtime, I would pay for the overtime. If it was just bad production, I didn't pay for the overtime. It's just not something that I felt was my responsibility. As bad as I felt, I just felt like it was, you know, to be honest, not my fault, and I didn't have the money to do it. I would always, if it was the artist's fault or there were some issues, and I'll go into it in specific videos. We had some colossal things. I got on a D12 video. We got shut down by the New York Police Department, so we literally had a full day that we had to make up, which is, you know, upwards of $250,000 in New York. But we'll get into that. That was the D12 fight music video. But we got it done, and ultimately, you know, it got sorted. So you do your shoot, you know, you wrap, everyone's excited, and then you go into the edit. Where, you know, the first thing you do, like I said, back in the day was a telecine. I'm guessing today they still have telecines where you sit with a colorist on a very incredible board and you can, you know, really manipulate the colors and, you know, what's known as crushing the blacks and bring things out to make sure that the picture is as spectacular as possible. You know, most of the time on video shoots, certainly back when we were doing it, it was 35 millimeter with, you know, cinema lenses. And so you had this really crisp picture. You know, there was a movement of 16 millimeter back in the late 80s, early 90s that gave it its own look, its own like kind of dirty, sandy, you know, over modulated kind of thing where, you know, like that, but that became a thing and that was cool. But most of the time when I was doing videos, we were shooting pretty clean 35 millimeter, setting the look. And then once you get all that footage onto digital, it would go to the editor. They would edit the video. The director sits, you know, would, you know, sit with the editor or whatever and get you what's known as a rough cut. I would always look at the rough cut, and I obviously had my notes and things that I liked, things that I didn't like, things that I wanted to change, stuff that I didn't want in the video. But I would always send that first rough cut for me to the artist, because I wanted to get back to the director and the production company with full notes. I know a lot of people don't do that. I know a lot of people make their edits and then send it to the artist. Unless the video is in such bad shape that I couldn't even send it to the artist, which can happen at times. Sometimes there are directors who have really good instincts on making a thing, but they're not necessarily great editors and they didn't have a good editor or whatever it was. Sometimes I would have to go sit in there for a night and just get it to a point where I'm like, okay, now I can at least send it. Because if you send something that's so bad to the artist, they'll rightfully so, panic and think that their video is unwatchable. So I never wanted to send them something like that. But most of the time I would get a pretty good cut, pretty good first rough cut, something that I would, you know, have changes that I wanted to make on it. But I would send that along to the artist and the manager and talk to them about it. They would ask me my thoughts. I would usually give them my thoughts. They had their thoughts. I would, you know, some things I like, some things. Sometimes I had to talk artists out of things or say, no, you look great there. You're wrong. And, you know, but, you know, ultimately it's their video. So I would do my best to fight for what I believed in. But, you know, in the end, you do give in to the artist's wishes as long as it doesn't, you know, in your mind, hurt the artist. You're never, in my opinion, giving them enough rope to hang themselves. That's not something you want to do. And most artists don't want to do that. I've found that the artists I work with tend to trust your sensibilities and they want to know what you think. And a lot of times they don't have a lot of people around them that will give them straight honesty. So as a video commissioner, I always felt like I wanted to give them the true, my true thoughts. So then you get it to a point where it's ready to go. There is a mastering process or a final process where, you know, you go in and finish it. You can do some final tweaks. There's some, you know, beauty work that can be done in the final edit. And then, for me that you know, we used to deliver on like, you know, 1-inch or D2 digital things. And it was a digital master is what we had. And so from there, and at the same time, once I had a rough cut that the artist was okay with and I was okay with, we would send it off to the video promotion department, who, depending on the artist, would send that to MTV, because that was the holy grail of music video, was getting onto MTV. Nowadays, you make a video and you put it on YouTube and anyone can see it whenever they want. Back in the day, when I used to work, do videos, I know that sounds so grandpa-like, but and I don't mean it in that way, but it really was a different kind of ecosystem where you know, the bigger artists would make a video and of course it would go on to MTV because that helped the channel get viewers. But there was a lot of young artists and up-and-coming people that didn't get onto MTV, but you would try. You know, you'd make the best video and hope that they would put it. If they didn't put it into big rotation, they would at least put it into some sort of specialized programming or something. But either way, MTV had a whole process where you couldn't have any labels, so there was always a blurring process because it was advertising. They didn't want people to get free advertising in the videos. So a lot of times, certainly in hip-hop videos, you would have Nike logos or Puma logos or, any, you know, Cargill, Kangol or whatever. Any sort of, you know, any logo of any brand had to be blurred out. So sometimes we would blur them. Sometimes we would just paint it with the same color, whatever it was. That was a whole process. And then there was also a standards, you know, kind of pass that MTV would do where they would go through and tell you what was okay and what was not okay. There was, you know, obviously there were various like no smoking, no drug use, no sex, no nudity. But sometimes they would just have things where, like, you know, when we did the Eminem stan video, they did not want Dido in the back of the, you can't have people held against their will. So even though in the original version of the video, Dido was in the trunk at the end when he's driving in, we had to cut that all out for standards for MTV. And I'll get into a lot of those specifically when I talk about the specific videos. But I would always try to send the video in its purest form, knowing that I would have, if there were 100 things wrong, I was hoping they didn't see all of them. And that I would make my 40 or 50 changes and try and get it as pure as possible. Because while I understood some of them, like the logos and others, sometimes they just got, you know, picky, nitpicky, and it became a way for them not to program videos. And there was always a push and pull between the label and the channel. But ultimately, you deliver your final video and, you know, hopefully it goes on MTV. And I remember, you know, there were some people who used to say, what's a good video? A good video is a video that gets played on MTV. I didn't always have that thing. I always thought video was an art form and really liked it. But I loved when my video got played on MTV because it was a way for your work to be seen by millions of people all at the same time. You kind of put yourself into the discussion of pop culture or, you know, music culture, and you hopefully are pushing the envelope to make people make better videos. So I always, you know, strive for that as a commissioner. I was always really proud of the videos most of the time that I did and that got on MTV. And when they didn't, I would try and, you know, send them around. There weren't a lot of outlets. You know, YouTube became a much I was pretty much out of the music video realm when YouTube came because the business changed dramatically. And there was a period where budgets were way, way down. Labels are doing much better now. I don't know that they're spending the salaries that, you know, a video commissioner would make a good living and was a high paid executive in the realm of the music video. I think they're making a lot more money now, labels are, but I don't know that they're paying video commissioners what they used to pay. So anyways, we would deliver the video. It would get on MTV. And as they said, the rest was history. There you go. That's episode 6, Commissioning 101. Hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. We're going to get into Eminem, Lose Yourself. I just saw the Oscars for a few weeks ago and realized I have really good stories about that video. Even though it's a little bit of a repeat artist, I figured I'm just going to tell the best stories I can on this podcast. So Lose Yourself is a really good story. Lots of interesting things happened from the just getting the song, making the song, 8 Mile, the whole thing. So that's it. Let's wrap it up. My name is Randy Sausson. This is The Commissioner. And as always, I'll leave you with one last thought. Sheet music is basically just the sound recipe.